welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is The Influence of Race Upon History, Part 2. Whenever, in spite of a great inequality of culture, two very different races happen to be brought together, the result is not disastrous for the inferior race, but it is quite the contrary for the superior race. It soon, in fact, will disappear in order to put in place an intermediate race which, from the intellectual point of view, may represent a sort of average between the two parent races, but which, morally, is always inferior to both. The past having been disassociated by heredity, the individual floats between two different moralities, and generally does not practice any. Most often what he plunges into and assumes from the races he emerged from are their vices. In other words, this morally base essence of barbarity that is met with in all peoples, whatever be their level of civilization. The products of the crossbreeding of the Hindu and the European, without speaking of the even more miserable ones resulting from the crossing of the Negro and the white, clearly show the sad results that are the consequences of such melanges. At no time whatever have half-breeds made a society progress. The only role that they can fill is to degrade, by lowering to their level the civilizations which by chance come to inherit them. We have an example which still remains in the present day. Hispano-American populations. The crossbreeding of the fiery and ardent Spanish race of the 16th century with inferior races has given birth to degenerate populations without energy or prospects and completely incapable of supplying the slightest contribution to the progress of civilization. The totally disastrous results that can be produced by a superior race intermixing with inferior races had been fully perceived by the most ancient civilized peoples. This was undoubtedly the origin of the caste system, which prevents any union between peoples of different races, and which we find still in place in many old societies. Without, mankind would perhaps have never gone beyond the dawn of civilization. Thanks to this system, powerfully sanctioned by religious law, the ancient Aryans, when they penetrated into India, at that time inhabited by savage hordes with dark skin, guarded themselves against any crossbreeding and consequently degradation and the final absorption that menaced them. Without the caste system, the brilliant civilization that they founded on the banks of the Ganges would never have taken root, and history would not have occupied itself with them. This system, therefore, played, in fact, an immense role in the history of the early civilizations. If, with our modern ideas, we find it unjust, the fact is that fortified by long-time traditions, it has outlived in many peoples the necessities that called it into existence. But if the crossbreeding of races who have attained very unequal phases of evolution is always fatal, it is otherwise when these races, each possessing different qualities, are reaching nearly the same period of development. Their differing qualities may then complete them very usefully. It is precisely by means of the intermixing of races already culturally elevated and whose differing qualities are able to make these races complete that the brilliant Republic of the United States has formed a country which is bound to soon surpass all the civilized nations of the old world. What has contributed, moreover, to the amazing strength of this people is the fact that it consists of not only the mixture of already very developed elements like the English, the Irish, the French, and the Germans, but more importantly of individuals who are themselves the results of a selection operating amongst the most active and vigorous inhabitants of these diverse nations. Nearly all the emigrants to the United States are bold, adventurous men who find the material horizons of their respective motherlands to be much too restrictive and limited, and also the moral horizons much too restrictive whenever religious persecution impairs the independence of their character. Hardy, ingenious, fearless, and sometimes unscrupulous, they soon ought to form a nation that no other can defeat or force into retreat. This nation's people only lack the artistic sense, which their ancestors also lacked. Indeed, it will not be from among poets, refined persons, artists, or dreamers that one may recruit these valiant adventurers who have proceeded to accomplish the conquest of an unknown world. The various general laws that I have concisely set forth can by themselves provide us the explanation of a large number of historical events. They show us, for example, why one such conquest had been the origin of a brilliant civilization, and why another one, on the other hand, had led to the commencement of an era of disorder and anarchy. Why the Oriental has always easily imposed his yoke and systems on other Orientals, whose mental constitution approximates his own. Why, on the contrary, the battles between Westerners and Orientals have possessed such a fierce quality and invariably conclude with the unmerciful crushing of the vanquished. These laws also tell us why a certain people has been a colonizer, and has known, whether naturally, if it is of the race of the conquered, and whether therefore to respect the customs, beliefs, and morals of the vanquished, if this race is too foreign to it, in order to maintain its authority over neighboring nations. Before laying aside the generalities on this question of race, capital in the history of civilizations, I wish now to say a word on the great problem which consists in knowing whether the progressive development of humanity has as an effect the tendency to equalize races, or on the contrary, to differentiate them more and more. The answer is easy to foresee. The higher level of human culture is ever advancing, but by this same fact, and since there are always nations who occupy the lower echelon, the abyss between these latter peoples and the superior races is each day becoming deeper. Most certainly progress expands, even for the most backwards of human groups, but the law of this progress is that its march accelerates in proportion as it advances. The superior races are now taking evolutionary steps of giants, whereas the others still require the many centuries that we have already traversed in order to be at the point where we are. And when will these lower races arrive here where we are? Undoubtedly much further into the future than today, if we have not disappeared ourselves by then. It clearly results from the preceding that in proportion as the various human races civilize themselves, far from marching towards equality, they tend to differentiate themselves from each other more and more. The same reasoning, moreover, is applicable to individuals. Civilization cannot have an equal effect on unequal intelligences, and because the most developed are necessarily bound to benefit more than those who are the least, one easily sees that the difference which separates the two groups must considerably increase with each generation. This difference increases in proportion as the division of labor, by condemning the lower ranks of society to a uniform and identical manner of work, tends to destroy in them all intelligence. It is necessary for the engineer of our day, who contrives a new machine, to possess much more intelligence than the one of a century ago, but in return, it requires much less intelligence for a modern worker to make a detached piece of a watch that he fabricates during his entire life than was required of his ancestors, who were obliged to fabricate the entire watch. Progressive differentiation between the races, progressive differentiation between individuals, and progressive differentiation between the sexes. Such are the inevitable consequences arising from the progress of civilization. Against such consequences, our vain reveries of egalitarian democracy are unable to prevail. Nature pursues its way without concerning itself with our theories, and we need to fully engage ourselves in its laws if we do not wish to be smashed by them. The preceding considerations are not only based on theoretical reasons. We have tried, for a long time already, to also strengthen them by coming up with anatomical evidence. The study of the skull among the human races shows us that if, in savages, all the skulls of the diverse individuals vary very little in their dimensions, in our civilized societies the skull dimension differences are sizable. Between the higher ranks of a society and its lower ranks, the anatomical abyss is as immense as the psychological abyss, and the progress of civilization deepens and widens it more each day. If, as I have pointed out, persons of the same race tend to greater differentiate themselves the more they become civilized, we are able to conclude that the more a race is civilized, the more considerable will be the intellectual differences that the individuals of this race present. Without a doubt, the average level rises also, and anatomy instructs us, in fact, that the average skull capacity of Europeans is a little higher to that of savages. However, it also shows us that the average increases quite slowly, whereas the difference in capacity between the most voluminous and smallest skulls of the same race tends to considerably increase with the progress of civilization. The comparative psychology of peoples confirms these anatomical observations, and based on the many observations I have made during my travels, I have come to the conclusion that the average social ranks of the Asiatic peoples, the Chinese, the Hindus, etc., are not inferior to the corresponding social ranks of Europeans. The real difference that exists between these populations and ourselves is that the former do not possess those superior men, the true incarnation of the powers of a race, to whom we owe the great discoveries which each day elevate the level of civilization. Such minds are met with more and more rarely the further down the ladder of races one descends, and one never finds persons of extremely high intelligence among savages. It is this number, that is the number of very highly intelligent persons, that provides the measure of the level of a people. The study of all civilizations proves that it is, in fact, a very small in number elite which are responsible for all the progress accomplished. The masses only benefit from this progress. However, they are hardly fond of exceeding it, and the greatest thinkers and inventors have very often been its marchers. Nevertheless, all generations, the entire past of a race, are elevated by these smart talents who are the marvellous flowers of the old human parent stock. They are the true glory of a nation, and everyone, including the most humble, should be proud of them. They do not appear by chance or by some miracle, but rather represent the synthesis of a long past. To favour their birth and development is to favour the birth of progress which will benefit all mankind. If we allow ourselves to be too dazzled by our dreams of universal equality, we will be the first victims. It is the obscure and hard-to-accomplish dream of vulgar mediocrities. Only the ages of savagery have realized it. In order for equality to reign in the world, it will be necessary to lessen little by little all that makes up the value of a race to the much lower level which it had once occupied. To elevate the intellectual level of the meanest peasants to the genius level of a Lavoisier will require centuries, whereas in order to destroy such a mind, only a second and the blade of a guillotine is sufficient. If, however, the role of superior men is considerable in the development of a civilization, it is not in the meantime totally such as one generally believes. Their action consists, I shall repeat again, of synthesizing all the efforts of a race. Their discoveries are always the result of a long series of earlier discoveries. They construct an edifice with stones that others had slowly carved. Historians, whose understanding is generally quite simplistic, have always believed one must fasten before each invention the names of a person. And yet, among the great inventions that have transformed the world, such as the steam engine, printing press, telegraph, and gunpowder, there is not a single one that we are able to say has been created by one man alone. When one studies the origin of such discoveries, one always sees that they are born from a long series of preparatory efforts. The final invention is only a crowning. The observation of Galileo respecting the isochronism of the oscillations of a suspended lamp facilitated the invention of extremely accurate chronometers, which produced for the mariner the possibility of his finding a safe route across the ocean. Gunpowder is like Greek fire, slowly transformed. The steam engine represents the sum of a series of inventions, of which each one has required an immense amount of work to create. An ancient Greek, had he 100 times the genius of Archimedes, would not have been able to conceive in his mind the locomotive. It would not at all have even served him to conceive it, because in order to bring into fruition the idea, it would have been necessary for him to await the machinery realized from the progress that has required 2,000 years of effort. Contrary to what most people believe, the political role of great men of state is no less independent from the past than the one of the great inventors. Blinded by the glitter of these powerful movers of men who transform the political existence of peoples, writers such as Hegel, Carlyle, Cousin, etc. have desired to make them into demigods before whom all must bow and whose genius alone modifies the destiny of peoples. Such political leaders may undoubtedly destroy a society or disturb its evolution, but it is not given to them the means to alter the course. Indeed, the genius of a Cromwell or a Napoleon does not know how to accomplish such a task. Furthermore, the great conquerors might destroy by fire and the sword cities, people, and empires, just like a child might burn down a museum stuffed with art treasures. But this destructive power ought not to delude us concerning the magnitude of their role. The role of great political leaders is only lasting when, like Caesar or Richelieu, they know how to direct their efforts according to the sense of the needs of the moment. In general, the true cause of their success has already been set in place well before their arrival onto the scene. For example, 2 or 3 centuries earlier, Caesar would not have been able to bring the great Roman Republic under the rule of a single master, and Richelieu would have been powerless to realize French unity. In politics, the truly great leader is the one who has a presentiment of the needs that have arisen, the events that the past has prepared, and shows the way in which he must engage himself. Nobody will perhaps see this way, but the inevitabilities of evolution are bound ere long to drive peoples to the destinies over which the leaders preside. In short, men of state, just like the great inventors, synthesize the results of a long interior labor. It will not be necessary, however, to extend any further such analogies. While great inventors play an important role in the evolution of civilization, they don't play any apparent role in the political history of peoples. The superior men to whom are owed, from the plough to the telegraph, the great discoveries that are the common patrimony of mankind, have never possessed the qualities of character necessary for establishing a religion or conquering an empire, that is to say, for changing visibly the face of history. The thinker sees too well the complexity of problems in order to ever possess very deep convictions, and too few political aims seem to him deserving of his efforts to pursue them in any sort of lively manner. While inventors are able to transform a civilization, only fanatics, those with a narrow intelligence but energetic character and strong passions, can establish religions, empires, and throw the world into upheaval. Indeed, it was the utterances of a hallucinatory, Muhammad, which created the force necessary to triumph over the old Greco-Roman world. In addition, it was an obscure monk, Luther, who put Europe to fire and the sword. For sure, it is not among the masses of mankind that the feeblest echo of the voice of a Galileo or a Newton will ever be heard. Yes, genius inventors can transform a civilization, but it is the fanatics and the hallucinated who create history. For the philosophers, history, such as what appears in books, is composed of a long account of the battles sustained by man in order to create an ideal, adore it, and then destroy it. And under the consideration of pure science, do such ideals have any more value than the empty mirages created by the light reflecting off the shifting sands of the desert? It is nevertheless the great hallucinators, creators of such mirages, who have most profoundly transformed the world. From the bottom of their tombs, they still weigh down the soul of the masses under the yoke of their ideas. Without being unappreciative of the importance of their role, we must not forget that with respect to the task they have accomplished, They have only succeeded in accomplishing it because they have unconsciously embodied and expressed the dominant ideal of their race and times. Indeed, one can only lead a people who embody one's dreams, as the following examples illustrate. Moses had represented for the Israelites their long-held desire for deliverance from enslavement by the Egyptians. Buddha and Jesus were able to comprehend the infinite miseries of their times and conveyed in religion the need for charity and pity, which, in periods of universal suffering, begins to force its way through into the world. Muhammad realized by the unity of belief the political unity of a people divided into thousands of rival tribes. The soldier of genius, who was Napoleon, embodied the ideal of military glory, revolutionary propaganda, and vanity, which at the time were the characteristics of the people who for 15 years he marched across Europe in pursuit of the most foolish of adventures. It is, after all, ideas, and consequently those who embody them, that guide the world. They come into the world at first under vague shapes floating in the air, changing slowly their look up to the day when they suddenly appear in the form of a great man or a great event. It matters little on account of the power of their action whether they are true or false. History shows us that the most fantastical illusions have always much more fanaticized man than correctly demonstrated verities. It is in fact the most presumptuous delusions that are the most apt to flatter the imagination and the sentiments of the general populace. It is the Mahamaya, as the Hindus say, the universal and eternal chimera, which under a thousand diverse aspects floats above the path of mankind, invincibly drawing over its traces. It is in harmony with these altogether formidable and vain illusions that humanity up to now has lived and will still continue to live. They are vain shadows, but shadows that one must respect, however. Thanks to them, our ancestors have known hope, and in their heroic and foolish journey, they have brought us out of primitive barbarity and have led us to the point where we find ourselves today. Of all the factors that play a role in the development of civilizations, illusions are perhaps the most powerful. It was an illusion that gave rise to the pyramids, and for 5,000 years covered Egypt with colossuses of stone. It was a similar illusion which in the Middle Ages had erected our gigantic cathedrals and led the West to hurl itself upon the Muslim lands in the Middle East in order to conquer a tomb. It has been the pursuit of illusions that has led to the establishment of religions that have brought half of mankind under their laws and which have built or destroyed the most redoubtable empires. It has not been the pursuit of the truth, but rather the pursuit of fallacy, which mankind has expended the most effort on. The fantastical aims that he pursues, he will never be able to attain, but it is by pursuing them that he has brought into being all the progress that he does not seek. And where the translator there has put the word illusion, I think possibly the word myth might be more appropriate. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and there will be more Albion narrations later in the year.